NAMS Medcast is the official podcast of the student coalition of La Asociación Nacional del Español Médico.
Hola a todos, and welcome back to NAMS Medcast, the medical Spanish podcast made for students by students. My name is Rafa, and I get to be your host for this episode. And today, I have the pleasure of being joined by Dr. Sandra Quesada. Dr. Quesada is the Associate Dean for Admissions, as well as the Associate Dean for Faculty, Diversity, and Inclusion at the University of Maryland School of Medicine, as well as being a Professor of Medicine in the Division of Gastroenterology and Hepatology at U of M. She works with medical Spanish in a couple of different capacities, given all of the hats she wears. So we're, of course, very thrilled to have her on the podcast. Thank you for being here, Dr. Quesada. Would you like to introduce yourself, or did I miss anything?
Oh, wow. Thank you, Rafa. And actually, I think you did a great job of introducing me already. Again, thank you so much for the invitation to participate in your very cool podcast. I'm excited to talk more. And yes, and in addition to the titles that you mentioned and those sort of leadership roles, my other role I'm proud of is being course director for medical Spanish. And I guess maybe in the future, I'll tell you a little bit more about how that all came to be.
That sounds great. It's actually, yeah, all of your roles are very applicable to what NAMS tries to do with our student and professional populations. And obviously, at this point, we're kind of focused in on medical education. So that's our perspective. But you're definitely the first time we've had the opportunity to chat with someone from the admission standpoint while also wearing the medical Spanish hat. So that's why we wanted to chat with you. Could you tell us a little about your personal history in terms of going into medicine and getting into the roles that you currently have?
Oh, sure. So personal history of going into medicine is, well, I guess it dates back pretty far. It was definitely something I started thinking about as early as elementary school. And it's one of those funny things where I'm not really quite sure where it came from because nobody in my family is in medicine or was. So I'm still the first and only person in my entire multiple sides of the family who is in medicine. Actually, everyone else in my family is in the humanities. They're writers, poets, painters, and they're brilliant. And then I'm the little science nerd that was running around the house. And so I guess I always loved science. I always loved the idea of being of service to others and helping other people. And maybe part of the like subconscious seeds that were planted was always being maybe more attuned to when people were talking about their health and telling stories about disease and different challenges that they were encountering, and just so wanting to be able to be part of the solution to whatever that problem was. So again, this was like a very early sort of maybe idealized view of what medicine was. But it certainly stayed and it grew. And through high school, I remember having a conversation with my chemistry teacher when I was a sophomore in high school. And him asking me, you know, so what do you think you're going to do with your life when you go to college? What are you going to major in? Or what are you going to do? And just sort of saying, I'm not really sure. You know, I love science, so I think I'll probably be a scientist of some sort. And I liked chemistry a lot at that time. So I was like, maybe I'll be a chemist. And then I mentioned, I was like, I'm also kind of interested in becoming a doctor, but you know, I guess I don't know if that's really a possibility. So I guess I'm just going to kind of explore things as they come. And then he was like, you can definitely be a doctor and you should definitely try. If that's something you're interested in, you would be great at that. And then that really stuck with me. I mean, here I am talking about it more than 30 years later, which is always a great thing to remember for me as an educator about how the seeds we plant, sometimes we probably don't even realize how impactful it can be for people in the future. But yeah, so I did go, I went actually to Hood College, which at the time, maybe they do now, but at the time they didn't have a pre-med track or anything. So it was kind of create your own pathway. They didn't even really have pre-med advisors. So this was also before the internet was really very helpful. And again, not having anyone in my family in the medical field, I did feel very lost. I didn't know what to do. What was I supposed to be doing? All I knew is I needed to take biology. I figured I got to take biology and I'm going to take sciences. So I signed up for like the science pre-med requirements that most people take, not really knowing necessarily if I was picking the right ones, though. I was lucky to befriend a great classmate who also was interested in medicine. I feel like together we kind of figured a lot of things out. I still remember her saying like, oh, I'm going to sign up for this course so that I can prepare for the MCAT. And I was like, oh, I should do that too. Okay, well, I guess I got to go talk to my parents and see if they'll help me, you know. And I was working, so I had a job. So I was using some of my own funds and also asking for my parents to help me a little bit with that too. And I'll never forget sitting in that MCAT prep course classroom, waiting for the instructor to come in and hearing the other kids in the room saying, talking about this AMCAS. And I was like, what is AMCAS? Like, this is the level of how not connected I was. And luckily I heard that conversation and found out and was like, oh my gosh, there's just a whole world out there. So that's probably going farther past the point of what you asked me for. But I think what I kind of wanted to stress there was more just the struggle that I think a lot of us go through who are, the only in our family, for example, kind of pursuing these careers and having to do a lot of it. Sometimes it feels like on our own. I think now that at least the internet is out there that you can do a little bit more digging. But I also think there's like a bell curve of how much is the right amount of information. And I think we've swung into this other side of the spectrum where there's just so much out there that it's hard to know what's a reliable source and what's legit. So hopefully maybe, through some of the conversation on this podcast, we can dispel some myths as well.
And that's great. And obviously I would assume that these are stories about your life that you have on the forefront when you talk about admissions and all of the things to consider. Even though I'm a couple of years into my own program, I've had the opportunity to mentor folks through the NOMS network and some of the affiliated professional groups for Hispanic and Latino students. And yet, like, it's always interesting to think about how some people go through this by themselves. Some people don't know how to integrate aspects of their own personal background during their medical journey. I think that's very applicable to anybody going into healthcare. It's very nice to hear that it's not just something that each of us goes through, but it's also nice to see that it's something that's actively being considered in admissions at this time as well.
Absolutely. I mean, I think it I know now, that I value all of that experience because it helps me have that empathy and insight into what that experience is like. And I sometimes like think, oh my gosh, if I had known then that I was going to be a dean of admissions one day, I would have been like, what? No, there's no way that's going to happen. So anyway.
And that's great. On the many hats you wear front again. So you mentioned you're involved with medical Spanish initiatives at the University of Maryland. Can you talk a little bit about that and how that actually fit into place in terms of your career at U of M?
Yeah, for sure. So I'm a lover of language, and I find it, linguistics very fascinating. Not that I studied them per se, but maybe some of that is also a seed planted by my dad because he was a translator. He is a translator. And so he always sort of imparted in us sort of the value of having more than one language at your disposal. And so growing up, so my parents are from Chile, and but I was born here. They came here in 69. So I was born here, and I always say that my first language was Spanglish because my dad spoke English to us mostly, us being me and my two sisters, we're three girls, and my mom would speak Spanish. And we pretty much just spoke English. Being born here again, going to school, and my older sister was also only speaking to me in English. So even though I could understand Spanish, I was definitely more confident speaking in English. Then we moved to Chile, eventually when I was 12 years old. And I'm so grateful for that opportunity. We lived there for 3 years, even though the original intention was to be there permanently. There, I, in addition to obviously being exposed and having the opportunity to become fluent in Spanish, also just met my whole extended family, which I had visited, but it really wasn't the same as like being there and then just absorbing the culture and understanding so much more about my parents and why they saw things a certain way or why we did things a certain way. And another thing I do remember, I mean, I was very fortunate to grow up in Gaithersburg, Maryland, which is a very diverse area. And so I was used to diversity as a child in elementary school. And then I come to Chile and everybody looked like me. And that was like an interesting feeling for me that was almost a little unnerving at first. And then I was like, wow, I guess I really belong here. Like there was that interesting feeling. I'm like, wow, these are my people. I did also sometimes miss seeing other, you know, seeing some more diversity, but I just loved having the opportunity to really just absorb and learn so much more about my heritage and then also perfecting the language to the point that it wasn't only this, okay, now I can speak Spanish and not sound like a gringa. I can speak Spanish and I can sound Chilena. Like that was like my goal. I wanted to have the Chilena accent, which if anybody's familiar with it, you know, it's crazy. It's not easy to understand. So coming back though, after 3 years as a high school student, I was newly aware of my identity as a Latina in the US, which I think prior to that, I was not. I think I had that much more appreciation for retaining my new skill set in Spanish that I had developed. So in college, even though I was pre-med, I actually double majored, or in my head it was pre-med, we didn't have pre-med track, but I double majored in biology and Spanish. And it was mostly Spanish literature. And I think that, you know, again, these are all these seeds that were planted. Before going to medical school, I was getting a master's in nutrition at Columbia in New York City. I was living in Washington Heights, which is like a very Latino neighborhood, mostly Dominican, but there's certainly a lot of, you know, folks from Puerto Rico and from all over really Latin America, but predominantly Dominican, at least at that time. This was back in the late 90s. And I got trained to volunteer as an English-Spanish medical interpreter at the hospital there, which on the one hand was an opportunity to get clinical experience and really observe physician-patient interactions, which is very important and something we always in admissions talk to our applicants about how valuable it is to have that opportunity. And I hadn't really done that yet. So that was great, but it was even more, I think, meaningful to me because it gave me this like unique opportunity to see how as a future physician and provider, having that skill set and being able to speak Spanish with my Spanish-speaking patients was so treasured by that community of patients, like just a look of relief and just gratitude. I think that a lot of the patients had when it would like walk in the room was just overwhelming. I mean, it was really, really wonderful. So coming then to Maryland as a medical student, at the time when I started, there was no medical Spanish course. And a couple of students and myself, once we were second year students, advocated to start a program. And fortunately, we had very supportive faculty who were all about it. And so we started a medical Spanish program, which at the time was fairly informal. It was more like work lunches or bag lunches that come together. Let's practice talking in Spanish, usually guided by the faculty on like a medical topic. Eventually I basically stayed to do all my training there. And as I was finishing up my fellowship training, so actually maybe I was like a second year. So sort of halfway through my GI fellowship training, it was becoming clear that I was going to stay in academics and I wanted to join the faculty at Maryland. And I got approached by our Office of Medical Education and Student Affairs, because in the interim between my years as a medical student and then as a fellow, the course had evolved, and it really had taken on more of structure. And there was a course director that they were meeting weekly. I don't think they were getting course credit. I don't think they were yet, but it seemed to be moving in that direction. But unfortunately, the former course director passed away. So they reached out to me knowing that I had been involved as a student. And since there was this possibility that I was going to stay, wondering if I would take it on, even if just for 1 year during my last year of fellowship, just to kind of keep the momentum going, knowing that there was so much interest and a lot of students who wanted to continue. And yeah, I said, of course. And so I actually started as a fellow. I started the program as it exists today. I remember presenting a new structure. It was the main thing that I changed was adding a service learning component to the course, so that in addition to having classroom didactics, that the students would also have a chance to rotate through clinics, serving Spanish-speaking patients and really kind of applying into the real world what we were discussing in the classroom, and getting approval from curriculum committee. It became a course, an elective course that, you know, gives credit to students, and it has sort of taken off from there. So since that time, I've been the director for medical Spanish, and it's been really awesome because I get to bring, obviously I have a longstanding, I think, love for this, and I get to bring and apply all of these different experiences from, like sometimes we talk about how words are different in different countries in Latin America, and I can at least talk about, well, this is how we would say it in Chile. I'm pretty sure nobody else says it this way, and you know, but also bringing in some of the experiences I had that I gained as an interpreter has been really helpful, actually, in being able to give some insight for our students so that they can also either use them in their own communications or also in validating and sort of creating that urgency and encouraging people to bring interpreters in the room when they're needed.
You just covered all of my questions. That was great. No, that was, I didn't want to interrupt by any means, just because you inadvertently touched on a lot of points that I was going to bring up, just in terms of a lot of issues that people run into when trying to get into medical Spanish education at any points in their training. And I didn't want to interrupt specifically because I really appreciated how just reflexively there was a natural flow to your life and your journey, which I think a lot of people should potentially note. Especially because I'm also potentially considering academic medicine as a career path. It's kind of nice to hear that your journey went full circle from experiencing a program or the lack of a program as a student, helping build something up, and then you being able to integrate that further along in your training, because I would assume you'd be able to reflect on all of those different stages and think about what's needed to better incorporate Spanish as a medical student versus as a third or fourth year medical student versus an intern resident, and not what you do professionally.
Well, thank you. I mean, I think that it's, you don't have to try hard, I guess, to do it when it's, you lift it. And I think you're all going to be able to do that. You know, you're all going to find a niche and also find gaps, right? There's so much we can still do to continue to improve curriculum for students in medicine, and so much more we could continue to evolve the curriculum. But a lot of the times it's not so much that we sometimes don't have the space to add more, but maybe it's we need to evolve a little bit. And so I think, you know, you all as current students and future educators and leaders in medicine are also going to have your stories about things that you realized were missing or could at least help benefit training for future physicians, and then have, you know, we'll all benefit from that.
No, absolutely. And I also really appreciate your insight in terms of your own cultural upbringing, your own cultural background, and how Spanish language was integrated, because I know from my own personal journey, but also from a lot of people we've had the opportunity to interact with as a student coalition at NAMS, is we obviously, everybody has their own story, their own difficulties with incorporating medical Spanish, whether or not they grew up in the continental United States or whether or not they immigrated here, how to better integrate all of those different aspects. So it's always nice to see people who've made it through the other side of the medical education journey who've incorporated that in their own unique way. We've had the opportunity to chat with a couple other people from the University of North Carolina and Harvard, and folks who've sort of integrated a lot of their own personal background into their own sort of perspectives on medical medical Spanish curricula. So it's nice to see that we can now add your voice to that roster as well.
Oh, well, thank you so much.
Yes. I did want to ask, just because this is a point of curiosity for us, just given the way this kind of education evolves. You mentioned you started your work doing formal interpretation work. Sort of that was part of your training and how it sort of got better integrated into your curriculum. And I know that sometimes, especially if you don't grow up or you don't train in a part of the United States that has a significant Spanish-speaking population, it's sometimes a little bit hard to get this kind of training. Especially, I live in the Midwest, so sometimes hospital systems have their own unique structures when it comes to determining what is medical interpretation. So I was wondering if you've noticed or like you've tried to drive a little bit of a shift in perspective with your own medical program in regards to what is now being called language concordant care and having it be integrated a little bit more naturally in that way.
Yeah, that's a great question. And you're absolutely right. I think that's, you know, one of the things that I think is great about NAMS is that I think that it's helping pave the way to have some more consistency across the country in what that means exactly and what are some of the sort of standards that should be upheld. And I mean, one of the things that we've been working on at least at my institution, and it's not Spanish specific, again, it is more about raising awareness so that providers will be more proactive in including interpreters in the, particularly in clinical encounters, because I think we can do a better job. I think that there's and actually I tell my students in medical Spanish that, you know, 100% part of the point of you being able to communicate with patients, and you're going to be rounding on teams, you're going to have patients that you're following, that by all means you should be applying what we're talking and help be that bridge. However, there is also a line here, and there are things that are not appropriate for you to be doing, like, for example, that you should be consenting a patient for a procedure. And then I clarify, I'm like, you don't even do that in English. If I'm going to do a colonoscopy, I have my fellow or myself do the consent. I don't have a medical student do it. And weirdly, when there is language discordance, sometimes I feel like the medical team forgets that. And they're like, oh, but this person speaks Spanish, so, you know, can you do this and whatever? And I've had students come back and tell me later, I'm so glad you warned us about that, because somebody kind of hinted at maybe I could do it, and I could be like very quick to say, oh, no, I can't. I know I can't do that. We need to get an interpreter here. And so I'm not sure if I answered your question, but I guess for one thing, I guess what I'm trying to say is that I currently am working closely with some of our campus-wide leadership on integrating a program, actually, that's going to raise more awareness about utilization of interpreter services and hopefully facilitate the access. We have the access to it, and I think it's being underutilized right now.
No, and that's great, because I think it did absolutely touch on the question that I asked, because I know that a lot of times, and this isn't specific to Spanish by any means, but sometimes when you're bilingual or have working use of or comfortable speaking in a language, even if there are resources within hospital systems, it's sort of assumed that that's the role you need to play, the one of an interpreter. But as you mentioned, if it isn't expected of a medical student or even as a first year resident, it shouldn't be anticipated just because you have that skill set, because we obviously are trained down at the undergraduate medical education level to handle a lot of those conversations. And I think a lot of people who've been in that position do rise up to the challenge. But if it's not something that they're expected to do, especially since they have to do, potentially they aren't used to using the kind of language that's appropriate to that point of the conversation, there's obviously this huge gap that people have to deal with.
Absolutely.
People rise to the occasion, but it's always nice to hear that we should be more than comfortable using interpreter services as part of a care team at all points in our education.
Absolutely. I mean, when I trained as an interpreter, I was fluent in Spanish, and yet I still learned so much in terms of terminology, and even, you know, on a few occasions got stuck, you know, as an interpreter, like couldn't pull the term, couldn't remember it, that sort of thing. And then we get trained on what to do in those scenarios. And actually, I use that training, and I share it with the students. You probably heard this, but basically, what the training that I got was, if you're stuck in a scenario. So, for example, to give you the real world example, was I was interpreting for in the surgical clinic, and it was a pre-op visit, and the surgeon is trying to explain to the patient essentially what's going to happen during the procedure, et cetera. And, you know, we're moving right along. And at some point, the word spleen came up, and I just blanked. And I was usually pretty quick. And I just, it was also, I do simultaneous interpretation, not the, you know, intermittent. So I'm talking, and then I kind of like hesitated. And then they noticed that I hesitated. And so anyway, the training is, if you can't think of the word, and this is makes more sense if you're an interpreter, is you just throw the word in English. So it was like, sí, le van a quitar el spleen. And so then the patient says, ¿el qué? And I say, the what? And they're like, the spleen. And I'm like, el spleen. And then they're like, ¿qué es el spleen? And I'm like, what is the spleen? And they're like, well, the spleen is an organ in your abdomen. That doesn't, oh, it's an organ in your abdomen. So basically, it was a much longer way, but at the same time, maybe better. Because maybe if I could have thrown the word spleen, but kind of was nice to get that full explanation about the organ itself. And then the patient's like, oh, okay, I get it. So it's always good to have those backup plans. I always, you know, encourage my students to be like, you know, it's okay. If you can't think of the word, the exact perfect word, you know there's a word and you can't think of it, don't get, you know, don't feel paralyzed by that. You know, just kind of talk around it, find your way through it. How would you have said this otherwise if you were explaining this to somebody, you know, what it is?
Yeah, and thank you for bringing that up, because I've absolutely also run into similar circumstances, obviously still much earlier in my training, but I've done some work with some of our local free clinics. And even though it's something as simple as a screening service, you obviously go through the like personal history, things of that nature. And I remember there was one case when somebody came in for just a general checkup or just a general onboarding sort of situation. And we asked about past surgeries or past medical history. And they very just calmly, collectively just mentioned the fact that le habían quitado las amígdalas. And they used that word, and people started freaking out because you're not supposed to take the amygdala out of the brain. And that was the general understanding. And these were folks who were like fairly versed in both English and medical Spanish in some capacity, but there was that lack of concordant that disconnect. Yes. And just the fact that, yeah, the what he was saying was they had removed, he had his tonsils removed.
Right, exactly.
But sometimes you just run into that freak out mode, especially if you're a first or second year medical student and you're just trying to get acquainted with the reality of the science.
Yeah. Well, you know what? You reminded me of a sort of a similar thing. And this was recent. This was with the COVID pandemic. Probably would have been in 21 because we set up a vaccine clinic. And so I and some of my students in medical Spanish went to go help interpret first, you know, so for some of the folks who were coming in to get vaccinated. And so we were asking the vaccine history, and one of the patients said, que le dieron la vacuna de pollo. And I was like, de pollo? And they're like, yeah. And I'm like, vacuna de pollo. And they're like, sí. And I'm like, okay, he's saying chicken. And I'm like, do you mean like sarampión, varicela? And I'm like, como chicken pox? Like, I'm thinking maybe he means the vaccine for chicken pox. And that's why he's saying pollo. Anyway, basically, long story short, he was saying polio. And I was hearing pollo, which is not what he was saying. But and I had like in my head made it make sense I was like, oh, he must be talking about chicken pox. And that's why he's saying pollo. Anyway, it was just like such a funny moment of like how many different words were sort of connecting in weird ways. But you know, you mentioned, I want to come back on a topic real quick, because you mentioned language concordance. And one of the things that also always motivated me so much to continue working with, you know, being part of the, you know, the medical Spanish program was seeing studies. And these were kind of old studies, so I don't know if anybody's done this more recently, but there've been several studies, obviously, looking at physician-patient concordance, both across race and ethnicity, gender and language. And, you know, across all of those dimensions, anytime there is concordance, patients are happier, right? So that they always, like, their patient satisfaction scores are always higher. There's also like a perceived, and it's probably not just perceived, but there is a perception that they're getting higher quality of care. There's longer time together. But of all of those things, language is actually always the strongest driver. So even when they survey and ask patients, which would be the most important thing to you, makes sense. And, you know, language is like the number one, because communication is so important. I mean, in every career it is, but especially in medicine, being heard and knowing that, you know, knowing that you can ask those questions and understand what the recommendations are. So I always, you know, inspire, hopefully it helps inspire students too. Obviously, I care a lot about racial and ethnic concordance as well. And that's part of what I feel like I'm privileged to be able to have a role in that in admissions. But the language concordance is why I feel medical Spanish programs are so important in medical schools.
That is very nice to hear. And I think it's very worthwhile for our audience to hear that in a couple of different capacities, because I think this kind of education is definitely in constant evolution. It's good for people to know what's to be expected if they're pre-med, if they're doing gap year transition education, or if they're actually going through the different stages of their medical education, that it doesn't have to click all the way. But they can be integrated within the process, work with faculty, and just make sure that they're aware of the different things that they should sort of keep tabs on to make sure that it's something that they can carry out on in their practice, and obviously provide appropriate insight for folks like you or for anybody else who has an established medical Spanish curriculum in terms of what they're encountering at different points in their training.
Absolutely. I mean, it's basically, it's a health equity strategy. And I guess I also just want to throw out there that to not think that to be a health equity champion or to really make a difference in that area that you have to be in primary care. Not that, I mean, we need those champions in primary care 100%, but we also need them in specialties. I think that there is still a huge lack of diversity among specialty providers, particularly the procedural specialties. So know that you will be very valued and very helpful. If you, you know, I was actually, I remember I was a first year fellow in GI and being told, because I already had a very much an interest in health disparities and serving minority patient populations, and being told, oh, it's too bad you're in GI. You should have gone into primary care. You should have done family medicine or something like that. Then you could have really made a difference. And so knowing what I know now, it's just so interesting, because obviously I think we all are more knowledgeable. I mean, that was like, you know, that was a long time ago, I guess. But since then, I think it's become pretty clear that disparities and also just opportunity to improve health equity exists across all the disease processes, and like literally any specialty field you go into, you can be a tremendous champion for that.
Something to very much look forward to. And I think I have gotten that sense from a lot of people in our community, that there are definitely unique needs and sort of developmental niches in each of the specialties. But if you have the drive, and as long as you're aware of the difference of the state of the education, then you can probably do a lot. And that's why I'm glad that there are people within this organization that are in charge of doing a lot of the linguistics and like the clinical studies to basically show the fact that like language concordance is very important over the course of development. So we can use those as a reference whenever we're actually trying to do any kind of tangible work on the ground.
Absolutely. And in addition to wherever your area of practice is, whether that's in academia or if you go in community practice, you know, definitely lean on and be engaged in those national societies for whatever your specialty is, because especially now, I think since 2020, so many more of them have become so much more engaged in that kind of work and are interested in pulling in future leaders who have an interest there. So for me, for example, it's been really wonderful to be very much involved in working with the American Gastroenterological Association, or AGA, and they've truly made a real commitment to equity, and it's been it's been great to be part of that. So I definitely encourage all of you, even whether you're in academia or not, even though there's like a direct benefit. I feel like if you're in academia, it's just like all these different ways that it honestly helps promote your career. But it also is great, right? It helps you develop that national network of colleagues, of allies, you know, co-conspirators, as we say, to learn from and to kind of lean on when needed.
Fantastic. So I've asked you a decent amount about your current role in medical education. I did want to ask if there's anything that's worth talking about your role in admissions when it comes to considering the importance of language, language concordance, or like language experience of the applicant pool going into a medical school, for example, and how that might translate into the roles that they end up playing, if you have any insight there.
Yeah, you know, this is so well timed, actually, because I was just participating in a AAMC focus group, because we're looking at the MCAS, or they are looking at the MCAS. You know, I think they intermittently obviously make updates, and language came up during the discussion. I've always been of the mindset, and then maybe this is my bias, but I feel like people who are multilingual have an advantage in medicine, because there is a part of medicine that is like learning another language to some degree. And I also think that being able to navigate different languages exercises that part of your brain that helps you to tailor your communication very thoughtfully in a way that you are like intentionally making sure you're communicating such that your audience can hear you, understand you, process what you're saying. And so I just think that those of us who have had to navigate more than one language have at least some practice doing something like that. And so I do think that I'm a little bit partial to people who, again, obviously I love it if people speak Spanish, but I also love it if people are just multilingual in general. It's not that, and we all had this conversation, it's not like there's like a point in a formula that it's like, oh, you get this many more points, but it's more just like, it's another piece of that whole picture that really just adds to the richness of the experience that this person is bringing and potentially will put into practice in the future. The question specifically that came up, and the interesting thing is they actually shared that it looks like this is a question that has already been added to the ERAS, or the electronic residency application system. So the question is about proficiency in English. And so asking applicants to rate their own proficiency in English and then also proficiency in other languages. And so the AAMC was, I think they're just, again, they're exploring options. They're like, what would you all think if a question like this were included in the application? And it was a small focus group. So it's not like there was like a huge group to pull from. They're doing multiple groups, by the way, though it's not that exclusive. I think they're trying to keep this open. But in the group that I was in, there was a lot of hesitation. And I think initially, like somebody said, like, well, I guess that could be kind of helpful because, for example, looking at the MCAT and seeing if somebody doesn't score well on the sort of the CARS section or whatever, the critical reasoning skills section, that could at least be explained by the fact that they may, you know, their English is maybe not their first language. And so you could kind of say, oh, even in spite of the fact that it's not their first language, look how reasonably well they did. Maybe not as well as the other sections, but there's sort of a context for that. I actually said, I was like, I don't like that question. I don't like asking people to tell me what their proficiency in English is. Mainly, I was like, for every single non-native English speaker that approaches that question, I think it's going to make them feel othered and make them feel self-conscious and concerned about how that information potentially could be used against them. So I said, I think I would prefer, the second half of the question was, aside from English, what are some of the other languages that you are proficient in that potentially you could communicate with patients in the future or something like that? And I was like, I think I would just prefer to start with that. Let's learn about the other languages. The whole application is in English. So by default, there is some level of English proficiency just to complete the application, unless it's entirely completed by AI or somebody else. But then that's also part of what the interviews are for, is also being able to gauge not just writing, but one's interpersonal communication. And so we should be the ones to get a sense of their communication skills that way. So yeah, in general, I guess getting back to, I think maybe what you intended with your original question is, I always see it as a positive. If there is somebody who speaks another language in addition to English, I think that's fantastic, because we are obviously living in a wonderfully diverse nation that only continues to get more linguistically and culturally diverse. And I believe that a huge part of my role, or really maybe the only part of my role, is to make sure that we are graduating a future physician workforce that's going to be able to take awesome care of our patients.
That's really nice to hear. And it's also really nice to, I guess, drives home the importance of potentially staying within a professional or academic role if you decide that that's the part of medicine that you want to pursue, because you can provide these kinds of insights as well. If you have the data to back it up, then all the better. But it's very nice to hear that there's this perspective that's being given by very talented and capable people at those levels, sort of driving and highlighting those needs.
You know, I do think that in our, we're living and working in a really special time, because there are a lot of us. There are a lot of us in medical education leadership positions who I believe I've seen for myself are strong advocates for all the things that we're talking about. And I understand why there is oftentimes the sort of reverse assumption or bias, because historically that is the role medicine has played. And so there are many of us who came through during that time who, for the very reason, like, we now are in a position where we can change that. And so that's a huge privilege for me now that I recognize I have. And so I want to make sure that I am using it to the fullest.
All right. Well, I think that's everything I wanted to talk about.
Great.
I think people will very much enjoy your insights. So we really appreciate you taking the time out of your busy schedule with everything that you do to speak with us. So thank you so much for being here.
Of course, Rafa. Thank you so much for the invitation. This was a lot of fun. And again, kudos to you for all the awesome work that you're doing. And, you know, que sigan adelante with this awesome podcast.
Awesome. And to all of our listeners, thank you so much for listening to this episode. We hope you'll join us for our next one. Nos vemos pronto.
Ciao.